All right, let's dive into it. So I was raised in a large Polish Catholic family. And so when my aunts and uncles would come over, there wasn't enough space around the dining room table. And so we would do what most families at that time would do, is we'd have an kids table and have an adult table. And I just want to share with you three metaphors for what I kind of see as current church ministry. I've got student up there, but I think we can talk about current church ministry. So this was what the kids table looked like in my house growing up. Let's just make some just blatant observations of things we see around this table.
There's no adults.
No adults present, right? Exactly, yep. What else? Just, what do you see? Just obvious.
Juice boxes.
Guys, I see juice boxes, yep. Good food?
Kids
food, yes. That looks like mac and cheese there, right? Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, in my house, it wasn't mac and cheese. We had sauerkraut soup. I know. It's as delicious as it looks. And me, being the youngest of all the cousins, they would go, "Hey, Wally, look over there. There's Santa Claus." And when I looked over there, what would happen to my bowl of sauerkraut soup?
It would get bigger.
It would get magically full, just like manna from heaven, right? What's the conversation around this table? What's going on? TV shows? There's probably some fart jokes, right? I love how this kid's just kind of off all by himself too, right? So that's one way that we do ministry. Now here's what the grown-up table look like, right? Observations here.
Proper and in order.
Proper and in order, decently in order.
Formal.
Very formal, right?
There are no plates on the right-hand side at the end up there. They're missing their plates.
Oh, they're missing their plates, yeah. Got fancy. What's the conversation around this table?
Politics.
Business, NPR, family, all that stuff, right? Food around this table is much different than the food around this table, you know? So, I want to show you a clip from book that it was also a DVD called Soul Searching. This is the study of National Study of Youth and Religion. Christian Smith and his team looked at 3,000 students from across all demographics, all backgrounds, both church and unchurched. And this is a video of a girl talking about her faith. And this is a girl who I would put as probably 15, 16, 17 years old, raised in the church. You'll hear her talk about her upbringing. What we would say, perhaps, based on her own kind of description of her upbringing, would be a typical, not only typical, but a poster child for our youth groups, right? So, as you watch her, as you watch this clip, how do you think she does articulating her faith? So, let's just watch this for a sec. So, some real hardball questions, right? What does Jesus have to do with any of this? And this is, you know, I wonder if we put the camera on our kids, would we get much better results? We can say, well, she's Nazarene. We'd expect that out of Nazarenes. I have no idea what that means. But I think we might get some similar results. And so, again, some things that we have to understand is, you know, this kids' table perhaps contributes to this problem. What percentage would you say of a student's time at church is spent with just their peers? Robert Epstein wrote a really interesting book called Teen 2.0, and he said just in regular daily life, I think the percentage he came up with is 80%, 86% of a student's time is spent primarily with peers, school, after school, weekends, those kinds of things. So imagine how much of a student's time at church is spent with simply just other students, right? I'm going to be conservative and say it's 90%, right? 90% of their time, youth group, before youth group, after youth group, even at church, they're going to be sitting with the youth group or their peers. And so it's no wonder that we get this kind of articulation of their faith that we just saw. Because they're just hearing like Jesus, like, man, my buddy. Not sure what he has to do with this. And Smith says, faith is a second language. We need to learn how to speak it. A student of mine, this is from the article, James Bond, the one-eared Mickey Mouse, says, my mother exasperates me because every day she asks me how my day is. She wants to know everything, but she never tells me anything about her life. That family drama is also true of our church. To be close, to encounter one another, we have to tell our lives. Let adults break the secret of adulthood, though we don't know much about life either. Let one talk of his divorce and of God's presence with him and what it means to him now. Let one talk about business, how much she hates cheating people out of their money, how much pressure it is on her to produce, what Jesus means to her during such a workday. Let an adult tell our young people how much he learned about his faith during the past 6 months. In this kind of disclosure, in this kind of our vulnerability, our vulnerability and our love has a chance to happen. Like thirsty folk in a desert, young people can speak with adults about what matters to them because these adults obviously know life and, however tentatively, Jesus too. If our young people are to bridge the distance between adolescent piety and adult piety, adult disclosure and vulnerability of this sort is no mere option, but a prerequisite. So there's these conversations that need to happen. So like I said, we started with these years of youth ministry and men's ministry and if you're singles ministry and if you're Lutheran, you got clown ministry. I don't know why they went into clown ministry. It freaks me out. Clowns just scare me. I know it's after lunch. But think about what other groups are we cutting off from one another as we fragment the church the way we have. And we've got into all these target demographics and what we can learn from one another if we were all kind of part of this church body. So that's one model. Go ahead, John.
I just insert that I think one of the struggles right now is that when we even change the church planning, that targeting of demographics has become almost a norm for naming what our success will look like. So you target Yosemite Sal and Sam, but way back with what's the big church in California?
Saddleback,
right? I mean, since that time, that kind of notion seems to me has become almost the model for church planning, whether it's a particular socioeconomic demographic or a particular age demographic. Ethos, the fastest Church of Christ in Nashville, certainly the one with the most baptisms in Nashville, but it's a single demographic church.
Yeah, and they're at a stage, single demographic, 6-7 years later, are starting to have kids, yeah. And the whole process of meeting in a bar without facilities for other things is causing all sorts of questions and trying to figure out how do they navigate all those as well. So that's one model of the way we've done, one metaphor of the kids' table and the adults' table. Second metaphor is a youth ghetto. And it's a portion of a city in which members of a minority group live, especially because of social, legal, and economic pressure. And I don't use this term flippantly, because I think in some ways what we've done is we've turned it into a portion of our church in which members of a minority group live because of either social, economic, theological, or social pressure, right? If I'm sitting around a group with my teenage daughter, I can get called out on my crap that I might try to say in class, right? Or if I can't fake it in front of my daughter, but if I go off into my 30-something's class or 40-something's class, I can talk about X, Y, and Z and not be held accountable by my daughter. But that changes when she's in the room with me. If we look at 1 Corinthians 12 and Romans 12, those are the body passages, right? And I wonder what those passages say about this. This is one of the questions I have. I look at those body passages. And the hand ought not say to the foot, and the foot... We're a body that has to work together. And I wonder, how do we get from this to this? Now, there's some argument you can say, well, this is a beautiful display of a body. But I would argue to say that this has not proven to be the most functional model of what a body does. I think it's been this kind of fragmented, almost Frankenstein, if you would. So I want to give you three ways in which the gospel, I think, is big enough for this idea of intergenerational ministry. How do we get 70-somethings and teens and 20-somethings and 40-somethings hearing from one another? And the first is the idea of the whole table. A gospel is big enough as one that's connected to community. So, we looked at the kids' table and the adults' table earlier, but let's make some observations on this one. This is, I think, a wonderful picture of what we're talking about when we're talking about kind of, perhaps, how to do church together. So, some basic observations of what we see here.
The great-grandmother taking joy out of watching her great-grandson enjoy a meal.
Yeah, there's a smile there. She's loving it. Good. Excellent. What else?
The kids still have their drinks, and the adults have their drinks, but they're all together.
What do you mean by the adults have their drink?
Well, yeah, Mike's hard lemonade.
Oh, they yeah, busted.
Just,
yeah, you got a sippy cup right next to a Mike's hard lemonade,
right.
You know, and a club soda for the Christian. You know, so you got non-Christians and Christians at the same table. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, well,
I'm just kidding. I like how there's paper plates and yet fine linen. Other observations? Anyone?
Well, the women are all on one side and the men are on the other, so they can communicate.
Oh, is there? Interesting. That's a new one. I've never noticed
that.
Yeah. I mean, you got grandpa and grandma and little kid here. And look, I love this. Well, I had a student point this out. You got an adult helping. The kid who can't kind of help themselves.
Up to the table, in the high chair back.
Yep. Yep. Right at equal space at the table as anyone else does. Interesting.
It's like this wasn't the most convenient route.
No.
Tell that table, that room is made for that one table on the end.
Yes.
And they've had to rearrange things to put two tables in a room designed for one table.
Yep.
So this wasn't the most convenient route.
Not convenient, not pretty. They don't fit together quite right, but they fit good enough. They work.
At least you might see 3 generations or 4 generations. Right?
Yeah, you see it 3 or 4 generations around the same table.
Well, this is last month at Winterfest. This was togetherness and relationship.
Mm-hmm.
One of the themes of the teams there. And so you're sitting in this convention center with, I don't know, 3,000 to 5,000 kids. And Jeff Walling's up there talking, but they show a video clip of probably college-age students acting out a scenario. And the scenario began with, I want to be a Christian, but I don't this church business. So they introduced the girl who was kind of the main character, introduced her friends to grandmother. They went over and made cookies with grandma.
Mm.
The relationship began, and the skeptic began to see the value of having a friend and going to her for advice as somebody who wasn't judgmental, who just listened and talked a little bit, and was told at first when she was skeptical about being around older people, but she liked the singing there, some of the songs, said, well, I don't like to sing those old songs. Do you know that grandma likes us all the time? She said, oh, well, I can sing those all the time. So it tried to get the point across, the value of having families and relationships older and younger together. This was directed straight to the teens. Now we're hearing it from a different point of view.
I think about the kids' table and the stories I hear around the kids' table, but then I think about this table and I think about the stories I hear around this table. Remember being at Sinbad Seafood Restaurant in Detroit and my uncle telling stories about my dad that I would never have heard around the kids' table, right? But the same is also true. Imagine the stories they get to tell that we have been missing out on as well. We go back to that clip of the girl and being inarticulate in their faith. How do we expect 12 to 25-year-olds to be able to articulate their faith if they haven't heard faith articulated at a mature level around the table? To hear the story about how this song, this hymn, is good news for me. So then, okay, I can hear or sing Old Rugged Cross or It Is Well with a whole nother layer now that I would never had without being around the kids' table. Share with you some research. Search Institute out of Minnesota asked 7th through 12th graders, who are the most influential people in your lives when it comes to your faith formation? We would probably think about who you would guess 7th through 12th graders would say. Friends, youth minister, those kinds of things. Now, here's the results. Self-reporting, 7th through 12th graders saying, here's the people that are most important, mom and dad. Over and above youth pastors, grandparents, and then friends come a distance, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. Friends are way down the list. And so it begs the question, why then do we take the most influential people and separate them from them on a Sunday morning? Late 90s, they asked college students who were successful in their faith, who are still actively involved in a faith community, why? Why are you still active in your faith community? Again, college students reporting this. And here's what they came out. They said, we had faith that were integrated into my family identity and practice. This is just kind of who we were. They had three or more adults of vital faith that they could point to outside of mom and dad. Other adults. They did service in Jesus' name and then again apprentice to leadership. They were able to use their gifts and their skills in church. And they got a chance to kind of try it out in a safe place. I remember growing up in Houston in high school, I remember saying seeing the seniors who went off to college. They'd come back after a week or two of being away at UT and A&M and those kinds of places. And they'd come back and visit. And I'm like, they were like gods to me. Right? It's like, when I go off to college, I can't wait to come back here. Do the same thing. So sure enough, I did that. 3 weeks into the semester, all my friends were coming back from Austin. I came back from College Station, went to walk the halls of my high school, and all of a sudden I was like, this is neat for about 5 minutes. And then I go, I don't fit here anymore. Which makes me think of that one-eared Mickey Mouse. And we wonder why there's that cliff instead of an on-ramp into the larger church. So, let's skip past this. Let's not skip past this. This is my house growing up in Houston. Not literally my house. I'm not Flat Walter. Any Flat Stanley fans? Billy, that's one of my best friends. This is where Oscar lived, and this is where my friend David lived. And if anything happened at Oscar's house, and I did anything wrong, what do you think happened? My mom got a call from Sally. Yep. And when we screwed up at David's house, David's mom, Karen, called my mom. My mom got a lot of phone calls growing up. But there was this idea of we have this shared covenant together. When we play stickball out in the and kickball out in the streets, the police would drive by and they'd look at us and they'd say, son, don't want to ever have to take you downtown. And these were cops who were saying it not out of authority and meanness. It's out of, I've got a responsibility to this community, and I'm going to talk to these boys and make sure they kind of keep their head on straight and they're and walking down the right path. And so we knew that they were on our side. And then what we learned at school and what we learned at church all seemed to kind of fit together. Right? And this idea of convergence, when the same messages are kind of going on all around. We seem to have lost some of that. I want to share with you this clip from Akilah and the Bee. And this is a story about a girl who's gifted in spelling. and she does National Spelling Bee. And I want you to see how convergence, this whole idea, the whole community kind of chipping in together works. So watch this clip. I got something in my eye. I mean, I think a lot of times when I look at this clip, I see what she benefits from this. But I look at all the different people in the community that helped her, and I think, wow, what did they get in return from her, right? And I think that's just a beautiful snapshot, I think, of what we're talking about when we talk about this idea of, you know, the gospel that we live in, this good news that we live in, is big enough for this intergenerational community. Am I saying, let's do away with the 1 year and spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with teenagers in the midst of our church? No, I think that would be silly. As one author puts it, I mean, there's times where teens need to be able to talk about things without adults in the room. Right? Grandma doesn't need to be in the room when we're talking about masturbation. But students need to be able to talk about that somehow in the midst of God's plan for some of those kinds of things that they encounter in their lives. But grandma better be in the room when we talk about dating. Because you know what? If there's anyone who knows what to say about that, grandma ought to be able to speak into that so we can learn from that instead of getting my cues from dating from the other teenager that I'm sitting next to who knows nothing. Right? This is one of those passages we have used to kind of beat moms and dads over the head and say, moms, dads, you are the spiritual leaders of your household, right? But I like to read it a different way. I like to read it this way. These commandments I give each one of you individuals that are to be upon your individual hearts. Impress them on all y'all's children. Talk about them when all y'all sit at home and when all y'all walk along the road and we all lie down, we all get up, tie them in symbol on all y'all's foreheads, right? It's a whole new reading of the Hebrew there. It's there in the Hebrew. It's Southern contemporary version of the Bible. But I think that communicates our responsibility as a body of Christ. So, when I'm talking in a hallway with Alan, who's in my life group, and his daughter Clay or Kobe comes up to him, I've got a responsibility to Clay and Kobe. So I'll stop my conversation and I'll go, Clay, Kobe, how are you? Tell me about your week. Instead of them being an invisible presence in our church. When I think about the 12, 24-year-olds, how invisible are they? I think they're pretty invisible a lot of times. But in the same way, I expect Alan to help me raise my sons and daughters as well. So I want him acknowledging my daughters and talking to them as well. Because you know what? If there's catastrophe that happens in our lives with our girls, they'll go to his wife Sarah, or they'll go to these other friends of ours, Gail or Chris and those on. So, a couple of things we've learned from soul searching. Number one, parents are the number one influencers in the life of a student, whether good or ill, right? So parents are great either encouragers or discouragers in the life of a student. Second, is we look at this, an average church only has 40 hours in a given year to influence the life of a student. We're Church of Christ, we go three times a week, so let's just triple those dots, right? So imagine tripling those dots, but you put that up against the parent's influence, and that's what a parent gets to influence in a year. So how do we think youth ministry can do better than what we can do? So something for us to think about. Finding number two is youth ministry is important, particularly in students who don't come from a faith background or whose parents don't come to church. So again, I'm not saying let's throw away the baby out with the bathwater. Finding number three, teenagers are of adult spirituality. So teenagers are fantastic mirrors. Another way of putting this is we get who we are sometimes. And teens can be brutal when it comes to that. But the most important finding I think they come up with is teenagers are being socialized into a much different Christian, quote-unquote, faith. It's not so much that we're being secularized, but rather subtly Christianity is degenerating into a pathetic version of itself that's being displaced by quite a different religious faith. And John's going to unpack some more of this in the next session, but I want to show you a clip from that same DVD, Soul Searching, where Christian Smith brings up this idea called moralistic therapeutic deism. He's saying this is what kind of in evangelical Christianity and a lot of our churches, that this is the kind of Christianity that our students are starting to pick up on. And this isn't unique to the students of what we hear them saying. I think they're echoing what they're hearing from their moms and their dads. So be listening to what moralistic therapeutic deism, but more importantly, what you hear the students. Right? It's moralistic in the fact that there's this list of right and wrongs that I'm supposed to do. So we could do this. We could make a list of what are Christians supposed to do, what are Christians not supposed to do, right? Hear those. You know, we've got those rules. What are, you know, what are those written and unwritten rules that we have in church? It's therapeutic in the ways that God wants us, again, wants us to be happy, have a wonderful life, want a beautiful life, right? We heard the students say that. And then it's deistic in that God's not really involved in my day-to-day operations. Or he's my backup plan, we heard students kind of say that. And there's not good news in any one of those. But I think what we heard in those students is a reflection, perhaps, of what we're hearing in a lot of our churches. And John's going to unpack some more of that next time. I think the second kind of area when it comes to this intergenerational, healthier family, healthier body that we're looking at is a gospel that's big enough to open to crisis and doubt. Have we created communities of faith where we're able to say, I'm broken, I don't buy this Christianity stuff. Can we talk about same-sex marriage intellectually? Can we, just any one of those? Or have we created spaces where we're like, we don't talk about those kinds of things here. This is church. So students come to us with these big, huge questions that may make them, that we're like, we don't talk about those things here. So they'll get on the internet and talk about it instead because they're going to find places to talk about it. Or do we say, we've got a gospel that's big enough. The gospel that we have is much, much bigger than we usually give it credit. Or do we allow a kid to say, you know what, I don't believe right now. And do we give it a big enough community to say, you know what, we love you, come journey with us regardless. We're not going to work on your behavior. We're not going to expect you to behave another way. You're going to belong with us regardless. Or do we say, no, you gotta, I wish Susie wouldn't wear those jeans. I wish these, you know, there was a whole leggings controversy at my daughter's school. And I like what one youth minister says. He says, I don't have a dress code. He says, because when a girl or a guy dresses in such or such a way, they're telling me something about themselves that I would not be able to know if we had a dress code. So again, he's allowing them to belong without having to behave in a certain way. And you can challenge that and you can push back on that, but I think there's something to that. So that they don't have to behave in a certain way. So that we're able to offer belonging that's not based on the way you behave or dress. So we have big enough spaces to allow our students who are wandering to still be loved and welcome and part of us. John Acuff wrote this article about how to scandal-proof your church. And he says this. He says, we've got to create an environment where it's okay for people to fail. He said, sometimes as Christians, we confess these safe sins and we sit in small groups and we say, I've got to be real. I want to be honest. I want to be raw like ODB and Wu-Tang Clan. So you lean in expecting some deep honesty and someone says, well, you know what? I don't read my Bible enough. Or don't do very long quiet times. And if you got one of those big neon sign sins, like porn or drug addiction, you can't follow the I don't read the Bible enough guy. He says, here's what we do. We fake it. We shine things up and we use what people call the Christian F word, which is fine. How's your marriage? Fine. How's your job? Fine. And we've got to make it church in a place where it's okay to fail, not to justify support, but to allow an environment where grace reigns, not judgment. So I was a complete jerk one Sunday morning to my wife. I don't remember what I did, but I was a jerk. And we drive to church. This is when I was working at the church that meets on campus at Pepperdine University. We get out of our car. I go one direction like you can at a larger church like that. We go do our church thing. I come back out of church. I look in the parking lot. The car is gone. She had left me. Now, she had every right to. I am not throwing her under the bus. I was a complete jerk. I don't remember what, but I was a complete jerk. But I had to shine things up. I didn't call anybody to say, hey, can you give me a ride? I was a big jerk to my wife. I could have and should have called like Terry Gibney, one of our elders who's as loving and caring of a man as possible, but I didn't because I felt like I'm the youth minister here. I got to put on a facade and I've got to say everything's okay. Ended up walking down the hill. If you've ever been to Pepperdine, it's a long walk down the hill into town. Waited an hour and a half because it was a Sunday bus schedule and took the bus back home. It took me about 4 hours to get home. All because I had to shine things up. And our students see that. And I teach spiritual formation in our for our undergrads and ask them, how many of you can be honest about kind of where you are in a church? 3 out of 10, maybe, in any typical class. So 70% of our kids are like, I can't be honest. We put on our shiny, happy Jesus faces at church. And so we've got to create a place where it's okay. And then a gospel that's big enough is one that's grounded in trust. Again, John's going to unpack more of this in our next session. Not in behaviors. Do we base kind of our acceptance and our love and our connection with 12 to 24-year-olds based on how they behave? Or do we simply just love them? I want to give you a snapshot from what I think is a beautiful picture of what we're talking about when it comes to this idea of a healthy church as an intergenerational, multifunctioning, multigenerational body in the term that we've started with, looking at this whole body of Christ. This is a clip from the movie Parent, not the movie, the TV series Parenthood. And what's about to happen is one of the families in this clan is about to adopt the son. And they're in the judge's chamber about to make it all official. And I just want you to see this as just a snapshot of what if this was how we viewed our role to one another in the body of Christ, not just a new believer, because the person that could be adopting could be a 70-year-old, which would be weird when it comes to adoption, but the metaphor fits. Imagine if this is the snapshot any time or every time we did a baptism. Pull it up right. Find out where I'm going. I mean, imagine if that's kind of how we saw our responsibility to one another in the body. And I think that's just a wonderful, wonderful snapshot. So, it's post-lunch. I get it. The energy's dying, so I'm going to require you guys to stand up, take 10 minutes before we get started in our next session, and John will take us through some more stuff. Get up, get the blood flowing, recaffeinate if you need to. There's a Coke machine down the hallway.